Welcome to KHOE's Historical Lecture Series. Today's lecture was given October 20th, 1994, entitled Bliss and Power by His Excellency Dr. Keith Wallace during the First Continental World Peace Assembly held at Maharshi University of Management. We join the proceedings now with introductions.
Continental World Peace Assembly and Keith's new course entitled Wisdom, Maharshi's Wisdom of Life, Bliss, and Power. And tonight, Dr. Keith Wallace will be speaking on choices. That's the title of the first talk. And Keith really needs no introduction, but Maharshi calls him the first scientist of the Age of Enlightenment. Keith is also the founding president of Maharshi International University and one of our most beloved leaders of Maharshi's worldwide transcendental meditation movement. So please give a very warm welcome to Dr. Keith Wallace.
Life is made of choices. But what is it that causes some people to make one choice, maybe a better choice, than another person? How did we define a right choice? Is the choice based on how much I feel about myself, or is the choice I make in my life based on what others feel about me? We can take many examples like that, just simple examples of how we dress, how we behave, how we act. And we can analyze these personal choices and try to get an idea of what it is that makes us make one choice as opposed to another. Is it something to do with the heart? Is it something to do with the intellect? Something to do with our ego or self? The thing is that the reason we want to understand this is because choices determine our life. You ever made a wrong choice, you realize the consequences of making a wrong choice. It's huge. You pay for it for a long time. You make a right choice, and everything seems to flow. Everything seems to just go right. It clicks. So obviously, this is very important to us. And in examining what is the basis of our choices, we're going to focus on the idea of personal choices, not so much choices in our business and so forth, even though those apply. But let's take the area of how we choose to behave to others, how we choose to behave in our family, how we make choices about what we decide to do each day for our own evolution. And if we look at this kind of simple concept of what it is that causes us to make a particular choice, we find that the basis of our choices lies at a more subtle level. And we can keep looking at one level after another, but let's just take the first, most obvious level, and that's our desires. And here it's an interesting thing because it's not just one desire or two desires, it's a whole priority of desires. And it's also based on our commitment to fulfill those desires. We can have many different desires, but some desires can be we can think that they're important, but the reality is we don't make much commitment to those desires. They're there, but really we're not really making a very serious commitment. Whereas others we make a very, very serious commitment to. And when we look at desires, it's very interesting because people often think, oh, I'm not getting this, I'm not getting that. But I think part of the reason they don't is because they're not really analyzing the spectrum of those desires. We often have multiple desires. I want to be enlightened. I want to be rich. I want to take vacations. I want to have a big family. I want this, 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 this. And if you look at every area of your life, you'll see there's some type of desire, whether it's your health or your home or your family, spirituality, your business. You've got a lot of desires there. And you're, in effect, asking nature to fulfill all these different desires. And you're making a certain contract or commitment with nature or with yourself, since you are nature, you're making a certain contract on what you're going to give to get that desire fulfilled. I'm going to work this hard and I expect that. I'm going to give this much to my family and I'm going to get that. So there's quite a lot that's going on in the inside, a lot of activity. And it may well be that you actually have certain desires that are contradictory, that oppose each other, and you don't even know it. Gee, I really want to get enlightened and I want to go to the dome every day. I want to be on CCP. But, you know, I was thinking of going to Tahiti or maybe the Caribbean, and gosh, after that I want to go on a skiing vacation. And so it's very complex. You should be able to fulfill both, and in principle you could fulfill both, but some will be conflicting. Like, gee, I really want to get to the dome in the morning, and boy, this is an incredible TV program. Ah, it won't hurt if I stay up a little later and watch the end of this. And those conflicting desires really affect our choices. And it's the clarity of that priority of desires within us that makes it easy for us to make correct choices. Now, let's examine more deeply. Let's go beyond desire, go more deeply into what it is that will affect our making choices and our making correct choices. Because we have to do it every day. Everything. We walk to our home and our child is crying or something, but we've got to make the right choice. What am I going to do in this instance? It's not something we can run away from. It's not something that we can avoid. Every minute, every day, we're faced with another choice. So, is there some permanent basis for making the right choice? Well, Maharshi gives a very beautiful, really a very succinct kind of program to make correct choices. And it's very simple. It's just a little formula. He says, meditate and do what you know to be right. Yeah, that's pretty easy. It's a magical formula. A magical formula. Because it has many components to it that we don't normally think about. The first part, meditate. Well, that is first. So that's our priority first, meditate. And we're familiar with that because we all practice meditation, but it's kind of eluded the world for centuries. And it's one of those areas of life where if you examine how it affects choices, it's so profound and so essential. Why is that? Because our experience of life affects our desires. Those desires are not just random desires, they're based upon our experience. If we have never experienced the unified field of natural law, if we've never had any inkling of what inner power, inner bliss, inner being is, then we have no idea about that desire. And it has no effect on our choices. On the other hand, if we have that experience, then it completely transforms our desires. It completely transforms our inner being. What Maharshi describes is that this process of meditating is a process of waking up. When we meditate each day, we practice transcendental meditation, we wake up. Waking up from waking state. And this is really the key to it, because what the biggest enemy to making correct choices is fatigue and stress. There's no greater obstacle to making poor choices than not having a clear mind. If you have that stress, that fatigue, the mind can't make correct choice. And even if you weren't meditating, this would be deeply profound advice, which nobody seems to be paying attention to. But it's almost clear to everyone that if they've had a good night's sleep, they'll make a better choice. If they're tired, they're upset, they're stressed, they'll make a terrible choice. When they come home to that child, they're not going to make the right choice on how to deal with the child. The scream, yell, so forth. Wrong choice. If they're rested, if they're calm, see the child, compassion, understanding, change the situation. Right choice. So this fatigue and stress are the greatest obstacle, and meditation is the most profound way to remove that fatigue and stress. It's a very beautiful quote from Thoreau. He says, "The millions are awake enough for physical labor, but one in a million are awake enough for effective intellectual exertion. Only one in 100 million to a poetic or divine life. To be awake is to be alive. I have never yet met a man who was quite awake. How could I have looked him in the face?" Being awake is the very instrument which allows us to make correct choices. Marcy talks about it as alertness. This quality of alertness is what allows us to be in tune with natural law. Being alert on the level of the intellect, being alert on the level of the heart, on the ego, and ultimately being fully alert and awake on the level of the self. It means discovering an entirely new realm of life. When we're tired, we're kind of in a prison. We just can't even see beyond the walls of that prison. There's just no way to get out of it. We're stuck there. And that tiredness just is like a chain. It holds us in. The minute we have some release from that tiredness, we suddenly see a whole new vista. We see a whole new experience of life. From this perspective, enlightenment is just a matter of waking up. Marcy says it's the simplest thing in the world. It's just remembering who we are, waking up, allowing that inner alertness to unfold within us. And when we wake up certain qualities within us. We wake up desirable qualities. People today, they want more power. They want more happiness. But what does power mean? Power can be in so many different forms. I can be a millionaire. Next minute, I'm poor. It happens all the time. I can inherit a lot of money, and I can lose it suddenly in the stock market. I can be in a very powerful position, and suddenly I can get removed from that position. So power is an extraordinary thing. It can come, it can go. I can be a movie star, have the greatest movie in the world, and I have a dud. Nobody cares about me at that point. So it's completely an ephemeral thing. It's something which is changing all the time. It doesn't have any permanence. And we see all kinds of seminars to increase personal power. But 99% of these seminars are on an emotional mood-making level. They do give us some different knowledge. They give us some different insight. But why do people keep coming back for more seminars? Why do they keep reading another best-selling book on how to get more power? Because it's on a very, very shallow emotional level. And for a brief moment, you have some sense, I'm more powerful. And the next day, you're faced with all your problems, and you get tired, and you realize you're not more powerful. It hasn't really affected anything. But for a moment, there's been a mood of power. You've had that experience. So meditation is the key to developing inner power. It's not outer power that's important. It's inner power. Through meditation, through transcendental meditation, we have this technique of waking up, remembering who we are. We're able to tap the power of nature. Marcy says, success lies in handling nature, in one's own nature, in oneself. So this is the key to gaining power, is to go not to the outer power, but to go to the inner power, to wake it up within us, to become more awake and be aware of that same power which holds together the universe, which keeps the galaxies together, to wake up that power within us. The Upanishads describe it very beautifully. They say, what is eternal, all-pervading, immeasurable, subtle, and limitless in manifestation? That imperishable being is what the wise perceive as the source of creation. And Confucius gives a very beautiful description. He says, absolute truth is indestructible. Being indestructible, it is eternal. Being eternal, it is self-existent. Being self-existent, it is infinite. Being infinite, it is vast and deep. Being vast and deep, it is transcendental and intelligent. It is because it is vast and deep that it contains all existence. It is because it is transcendental and intelligent that it fulfills or perfects all existence. In vastness and depth, it is like the earth. In transcendental intelligence, it is like heaven. Infinite and eternal, it is infinite itself. So this understanding of what real power is not a new experience. It's an experience that's been there in every great tradition. It's been in great scientists, great poets. They've experienced this for themselves. It's a well-known experience. We see it everywhere. We see it in athletes. We see it all over the place. People touch that inner power, that source of power, and they have no idea what it is, but they love it. And then they want to get it back, but they don't have a technology. And the other area, happiness, is also an area people want very much. But how do they get happiness? What does it mean? Does love bring us happiness? Does possessions bring us happiness? Do surroundings bring us happiness? Yes, to some degree they all bring us happiness, but again, they can change. Those situations can change in life. We see it all the time. Surroundings change, relationships change. They all change. So obviously we have to go to a more permanent source of love. And Marshy describes that as bliss. He says, bliss is not a quality life can have or not have. It is life. The nourishment of life from within is nothing other than this. When the physiology regains bliss, it is not something merely pleasant or delightful that is happening as a new experience. The body is being linked back to its basic back to its basic structure, which is organized in bliss before any physical values appear. Anytime consciousness deviates from the self-referral path of bliss, then problems arise. Consciousness is meant to have its own physiology, and the primary value of that physiology is wholeness. Any loss of wholeness, however small, is enough to create a complete breakdown. As soon as there is one fragmentation, then the process is started from which a million fragments must result. All are alike from the viewpoint of unity, because all are the absence of bliss. Without wholeness, consciousness is deprived of bliss. It has lost the basic structural element it needs to create its physiology. When consciousness forgets this and sickness arises, then basically consciousness has forgotten itself. Connectedness is not always lost, it's only the memory or reminder that is lost. The material value disguises the sameness of mind and body by covering over the bliss. One sees a heart cell and a bone cell, a molecule. They all look different. This is hiding the real value. That is, all these individual fragments are fundamentally the same. The beauty of bringing bliss back into life is that it is so intimate to each person, being only his self, that it is irresistible. No one can resist himself, what he really is. When bliss rises in world consciousness, every person will innocently recognize that life is bliss. This realization alone, without any further action, establishes the individual life in perfect harmony and brings it back in touch with the outer harmony of nature. Inner and outer were never different, but when one was forgotten, then both were lost. In truth, they are the same indestructible value expressed on a finite scale and an infinite scale. The body is a walking universe. The universe is a cosmic body. So bliss, then, is a quality that comes by waking up the physiology from the inside. The Upanishads say, from bliss all beings are born, by bliss they are sustained, and into bliss they again return. Through transcendental meditation, we wake up this inner power, this inner bliss. In doing that, we change our experience of life, an extremely profound change. Marshy says, once this immortality of life, this inner quality of bliss and power has been tasted, then the individual is satisfied. That's like the taste of honey that one can never go away from. One always has to have it again. One has tasted that immortality. And that affects our desires, completely transforms our desires. And it changes the priority of desires. And suddenly now, all those desires have to get rearranged. And every time we have that experience of bliss, it reminds us again, oh, that's what I want. That's really what I want in life. That is really going to bring me something permanent. These other things, they're fun and they're great and they're enjoyable, but this one thing changes everything. And once we've had that experience, it reinforces our desire for more of that experience. We shift our desires and commitments in a natural way. There's no mood making, there's no strain, there's no problem. That commitment comes very, very naturally. And this affects how we make choices. We've woken up the bliss and power within our physiology. It affects our intellect. Our intellect is more clear. It affects our heart. Our intuition, our sense of love for another person is affected. We're more sensitive, more discriminating. We're aware that the greatest enemy to life is fatigue that clouds over that inner experience. We're sensitive to when we're tired, when we're not tired. We're sensitive to what it does to our heart, what it does to our intellect. And this then is obvious. If we're going to make correct choices, we have to do something first to our inner physiology. We have to wake it up. We have to wake up those desires. Naturally, everything changes after that. Once we remove that stress and fatigue, an incredible thing happens. We get intuition. Intuition is the most profound faculty for making choices. It's so amazing to know that something is right. And it seems that women have this trait, maybe because the heart is more full all the time, with a child and so forth or whatever, they have this trait in a more obvious way. They naturally have a feeling, this is right, this is wrong. Now, it can be in men, but in the way we've been brought up in our scientific age, you see often that dominance of men in business making intellectual decisions, not intuitive decisions. But it shouldn't be that way. Both men and women should have equal amounts of intuition and intellect. It should be a combination of both. The wise in the past weren't intellectual people, they were intuitive. The wise leaders of society knew what was right. So that is obviously something we have to wake up for better choices. We need that proper blend of intellect and heart. We need them to be coordinated and not opposed to each other. Then we naturally make better choices. And something happens which is so extraordinary, a phenomenon happens which is marvelous, and that is we get support of nature. There's no more profound concept in the world than this concept. It's just at the heart of everything Maharishi teaches. It's such a beautiful, profound, amazing concept, and we just don't have it in our society. We have no idea of it in our society. Everything is based upon working hard for this. We don't have that idea that, oh, gee, I want to call my friend. Boom, he calls me on the phone. Gee, I want to get this parking space. Suddenly somebody leaves right in front of us. Just that spontaneous support of nature. Maharishi really describes man as having the total potential of natural law. Natural law wants to help us. Nature wants to help us. It delights in helping us. But if we don't have clear desires, if we're fatigued, we're stressed, then how can nature help us? Oh, what do you want? You want to stay up late and watch this movie and have the newest television and cable TV. And you want to get up in the morning, too, at the same time to go to program? That's an interesting problem. How can nature really help you if you don't even know what you want yourself? If you don't have a sense of your own priorities? The most powerful form of life is supportive nature, where we're gliding through life and nature is organizing for us. This is really what life should be. Maharishi says in Ayurveda, there's this beautiful phrase, it's Amrit Putra, O son of immortality, man should inherit all the power and bliss of nature. That's his natural birthright. Why he doesn't have it? Fatigue and stress. Nature can't support that which is unclear, that which is fatigued. And we have an extremely beautiful discovery this year that's come out as a result of Dr. Tony Nader. Very profound discovery. Maharshi's extremely happy with this because it really enables us to bring Veda out on a very logical and scientific basis. And this is the discovery of Veda in physiology. Dr. Nader has made a very careful analysis of the physiology. I mean, for hundreds of years, people have studied the anatomy of the physiology. But what he's done is to correlate this anatomy with the 27 branches of the Vedic literature. And there's an unbelievably precise correspondence. You take something like the Yoga Sutras, and you look, and there are four parts, and then you compare this with the four lobes of the brain, then you count the exact numbers of little gyri on the brain in each of these lobes, and it corresponds exactly with the number of sutras in each of these branches of the Yoga Sutras, these four divisions of the Yoga Sutras. You look at it, you can do this on so many different structures of the brain, and it's very, very interesting. And it's been there in every culture that man is the microcosm of the macrocosm. Within man is the whole universe. All these great religions and traditions have seen man in that way. And here it is brought out in a very concrete way. And it gives us really the basis for understanding what supportive natural law is, because it means that we're a walking, living Ved. We are a walking storehouse of natural law. All those natural laws exist within us in a very condensed, powerful form, and we just have to wake them up. And once we wake up that holistic functioning of all of them, then very naturally we're in tune with all the laws of nature. We have kind of a synchrony between ourselves and nature, which is very unusual in this age when we're so totally out of sync with nature. We live in concrete buildings. We don't even know if the sun's coming up or not. We don't even have a sense of the basic rhythms of nature, let alone being in tune on a very profound basis. So this waking up brings us in tune with nature. This idea of supportive nature has been there, again, in every tradition. There's a beautiful little passage that the Roman orator and statesman Cicero says. He says, "There is, in fact, a true law, which is in accordance with nature. It applies to all men and is unchanging and eternal. By its command, this law summons men to perform their duties. By its prohibitions, it restrains them from doing wrong. The man who will not obey it will abandon his better self, and in denying the true nature will thereby suffer the severest of penalties." So it's very clear, if you acted not in accord with natural law, there was some effect on your life. You made the wrong choice, and you paid the consequences. So it makes it real obvious why you want to make the right choice. Maharshi talks about Vedic mathematics. He says, how does nature compute how one choice has so many effects on the universe? It's just unbelievable, the computation that nature makes. We do something, and every part of nature is affected. And we get a reaction back from every part of nature. So we do something right, nature rejoices, responds back in the right way. We do something wrong, who knows what those computations will bring and when they'll bring it. But it's all going on in a very, very spontaneous way. So obviously, we want action in accord with natural law. We want to be brought in harmony to ourselves and others. Maharshi says, action in accord with natural law is that action which brings maximum benefit to ourselves and others. So the question is, will meditation ensure that our actions are always in accord with natural law? And there's a very beautiful story which gives us an insight to this, and it comes from the Gita, very beautiful encyclopedia of Vedic knowledge. And in one part of the Gita, we have a very beautiful story of Arjuna on the battlefield. He's faced with the most difficult choice any individual could be faced with. He has in front of him an army that has done, of individuals that many of who have done very bad things. They've disrupted the land, they've committed all kinds of atrocities. And he is sort of the defender of truth. his army is sitting behind him, and he has to fight this army. And he comes in very strong with great duty. These are wicked people disrupting the kingdom. It's his dharma, his duty, to correct the situation. And as he stands before, ready to go out to victory, Krishna says one phrase to him. He says, "O son of Kunti." And this suddenly transforms him. He tells him that those people out there that you're about to slaughter are your relatives. They're your family. And this totally disrupts him. His heart and mind are divided. His mind says, go out there and fight. But his heart says, these are my family. How can I kill my family? Couldn't be a more difficult choice. You couldn't create a situation with a more difficult choice. What does he do? Nothing. He can't do anything. He's totally in a state of inaction. He's divided. He just sits there paralyzed, not knowing what to do. How does Krishna deal with him? Krishna is his teacher. Krishna is the most skilled teacher in the world. He says that phrase for a very specific purpose. He wants Arjuna to make the right choice, but he has to take his mind to the transcendent first to make that right choice. And how does he get Arjuna to go to the transcendent? First of all, as a good teacher, first principle in teaching, make the pupil receptive. Get the pupil receptive. The pupil has to want to learn. He knows that Arjuna is very devoted to him. Arjuna has a very profound commitment in life. He's understood the greatness of Krishna, and he's very committed to Krishna as his teacher. So he is willing to learn from Krishna. And once he gets into this state, see, Arjuna is a very special person. He's incredibly pure. He obeys laws beautifully. He's just an incredibly refined, dignified individual. Everything he's done in life has been right. He's almost enlightened, but not quite. Some little stress is there. And this is the moment for him. This is the moment. So what does he do in this moment? He does something very simple. He makes one simple choice. He says, this is my teacher. He knows more than me. I can't do anything. I can't decide what to do. This is a horrible situation. So all I'm going to do is ask my teacher what to do. Really a nice, simple choice. And this is exactly what Krishna wanted from him. He wanted him to be receptive. He wanted him to be in the state where he realized that he couldn't, with his human intellect, make the correct choice. He had to go beyond the intellect. And Krishna gives him very simple advice. Nistro gunya bhav Arjuna. Be without the three gunas, Arjuna. Transcend. Have that experience of the absolute. Interesting thing that happens to Arjuna, all he needs to do is transcend once. He goes there, boom, he's enlightened. Maharshi said, if I only had one Arjuna. So obviously this is the most effective way of making correct choices. If we were in that state of 99% pure, we just have to transcend once, one meditation, it's done. From then on, we make the correct choice. Our life, our will, is in tune with nature's will. We are completely awake to all these 27 branches of the Vedic literature. We're completely awake to every impulse of natural law. We're able to work on that level of Vedic mathematics, that level where everything is computed perfectly. We make always the right choice. That is the ideal. And for Arjuna, it happened simply because of his commitment to the teacher. And this brings us to the second part of this little formula Maharshi gave. Meditate and do what you know to be right. So we meditate, we remove the stresses, but unlike Arjuna, we have a few more remaining. So how are we going to go through life? What are we going to do? We've done our meditation, we've come home. We still have to make a choice. We know we're not completely enlightened, so we know, gee, we're not exactly sure if this is going to be the right choice or not. Well, the first thing we want to know is, well, when am I going to be enlightened so I don't have to worry about this anymore? And Maharshi, on this tape I heard recently, somebody asked him that question, and he said, all we know is one thing. When we meditate, we know we've accelerated the path enormously. It's not going to take hundreds of years. It's going to take a very short period of time. But we don't know how much stress is left in that little brain. So we just don't know how many more meditations. And not knowing that, we still have to make choices. We're still faced with these things. We can't say, okay, well, in 2 weeks, in 3 days, in a second, I'm going to be enlightened, so I'll make all my big decisions after that. We just have to go through life making these big decisions as they come up. So we meditate every day. We do our program. And we just have to follow this other little advice that Maharishi's given us. Do what we know to be right. Now, what is that? Well, Maharishi's given us good advice here. In the past, he said, go to your traditions. Look in those traditions. Find what is good. We've known that all the religions of the world, the great teachers, gave incredibly beautiful advice. They weren't always interpreted and carried on by their followers in the best way. We know that religion as such, has been kind of confused. And what we think of, you know, that we've gone so far in our own society as to completely remove religion or cultural traditions even from our education, to the point where we have the separation of state and church. Why? Maharishi says, because the politicians don't trust what happens through religion. We have this very strange situation where they don't want God in religion, Maharishi says. They say that a religious person is poison. What is the use when he can't even help his neighbor? In fact, we are caught in a very awkward situation where we don't trust religion because we don't always trust the people who are proposing it. But yet we can go back to the original teachings. We can go back and see this knowledge, and we can do our best to revive it. And Maharishi's whole program in creating heaven on earth is to go back to these traditions and try to enliven them through the Veda, using the Veda as a real foundation and to enliven these cultural traditions. Because in the past, there was always a situation where there was the wise leaders of a village. I mean, I don't know a town in the United States where you can go to the wise leaders and get some advice. It doesn't work that way. Nobody trusts the wise leaders. Nobody trusts politicians. There just isn't that kind of tradition that's there. What do we do in place of it? Well, starting with the 60s generation or maybe before that, we rebelled. We absolutely said, hey, there's nobody wise here in society, so why should we follow anybody? And we eliminated this concept completely to the point where we destroyed values. Now we have that situation with our own children, where they're growing up in a totally valueless society, where we don't even have the simple values, even though as incorrect and impartial as they are, they're not even there. They're not even acting as guidelines. What do young people do? They look toward rock stars and movie stars as their model. They dress like them. They behave like them. It's the most absurd situation in the world. It is absolutely ridiculous. And why is it there? I mean, who are they following? These people have the most self-destructive habits in the world. You couldn't find people that are more self-destructive, and we're going to follow them. So where do you go to? You go to education. But these are some of the lowest paid people, again, in the United States. It's not exactly who you want to entrust your children with. And they, even if they're good people, there's a lot of great teachers, but even they have a terrible situation because they can't introduce values. Values are not scientific. So where are you going to educate your child? Where are you going to have that kind of situation? The whole society is upside down. I think everybody's had this experience. When I was young, the thing that I wanted most when I was in high school was somebody I could respect. I was just looking for anybody that I could respect. It was always disappointment. I thought, oh, this is a great teacher. And then I find out, oh, God, he did that. Oh, gee. How can you respect the person? And meeting Maharishi was the greatest joy in the world. It was just like a miracle. Here was a person you could respect. This was a true person. And I think everybody, if you look in those early tapes of the movement, and Humboldt especially, where people were asking Maharishi for every bit of advice in the world. They asked him every question they could about every area of life because they were dying to ask somebody who they respected how to behave in this situation. And Maharishi very gently and beautifully told everyone. And so we do have some kind of a formula here. We have meditate and do what you know to be right. So obviously, priority is meditate. But there's also another thing which Maharishi has introduced to help us. One, revive our traditions. Two, just examine his knowledge. And further, keep up with his knowledge because he's constantly bringing out new areas. For example, Jyotish. What a wonderful area for predicting the future, knowing how to make correct choices. Stipatyaveda, how to make correct choices for building. Ayurveda, how to prevent disease. Again, tremendous advice. All of Maharishi's emphasis in these last few years has just been to unfold that most fundamental tradition of knowledge which helps us make choices, which gives guidelines for making correct choices. So we have something very great here. We have a huge wealth of knowledge. We have many, many techniques that Maharishi has brought out. Techniques of fundamentally meditation, then TM City program, group practice, living in a community, studying all these branches of the Veda, learning Sanskrit, reciting Sanskrit, marvelous techniques, incredibly powerful techniques, all designed to help us make correct choices. We are the most fortunate people in the world because we have an enlightened teacher. No matter what happens out there, whatever, we have an enlightened teacher. That is such a precious thing. And not only do we have an enlightened teacher, but we have hundreds and hundreds of hours of videotape of Maharishi. As a student who goes to this university, they see hundreds of hours. As a faculty member, you come in and you put on the tape and, you know, for an SCI block or something, you're just amazed. You've seen this tape before. Maybe you were there when the tape was made, but it's totally different when you listen to Maharishi after you've been meditating for a while. Because now you're more mature, you have a family, you realize I've got to make some tough choices here. What do I do? And Maharishi's given advice in every possible area. He is a wise teacher. He is the Krishna of our world. We like Arjuna then, can go to Maharishi. If we can't go to him directly, we can go to his knowledge in tapes or book, and we can get that knowledge. Now, the thing that Maharishi has done is he hasn't made it so rigid that people get fanatical and say, well, Maharishi said this, I've got to do that. He said, meditate and do what you know to be right. So he's made it very easy for us. He hasn't forced us to follow his advice this way or that way. He's just said, meditate, you'll spontaneously transform your desires within you. This priority of desires will change. It'll happen on a physiological level. It'll wake up this inner resources of the brain. He's very fond of this research from Professor Lubomov, which shows this more holistic functioning of the brain during TM. It's as if we're waking up the hidden reserves of the brain. And so this is our most powerful technology, but we also have all the great advice he's given to us on courses and so forth and in tapes. And it's beautiful knowledge. Let me just read a few quotes from Maharishi. He says, naturalness is the basis of effectiveness. If one poses to be something else, one loses the charm of naturalness. The result is one accumulates a stress. We do not think of life, we live it. We do not think of ourselves too much. We not think of others too much. We just behave in a natural way. Don't make moods. We don't wonder what anyone thinks of us. We do not live our life on the remarks of others. It is enough that we are naturally helpful to others. What others think of us is not our concern. It is their concern. If we are weak, we will always put ourselves at the whims of others. We do not base our lives on the opinion of others. But if we are not clear in our conscience, then we will always be weak. And we will always mind the looks and remarks of other people. It is the weakness of individuality if it is always looking to others. It is important only that we radiate life. Each individual must be a joy to himself, to his family, and to his society. So fundamentally, the advice that Maharishi has given us is to be natural. But again, we still have to make choices. So we'd like some more advice. So he says more in different tapes. He says, enjoy your life and be happy. Being happy is of the utmost importance. Success in anything is through happiness. More supportive nature comes from being happy. Under all circumstances, be happy, even if you have to force it a little bit to change some long-standing habit. Just think of any negativity that comes to you as a raindrop falling in the ocean of your bliss. You may not always have an ocean of bliss, but think that way anyway, and it will help to come. Doubting is not blissful and does not create happiness. Be happy, healthy, and let that love flow through your heart. So he's telling us to be natural, but he is saying you can favor this side of life. There is definitely some advice there to favor this more ocean of bliss than the doubting. So don't be superficial. Don't create a mood. On the other hand, make a choice for what you know to be right. Go in that direction which is positive and good. How do we deal with another person that might hurt us? We often are faced with these situations where we're trying to be good, but somebody's really coming on us and assaulting us. Maharishi gives very beautiful advice. He says, whatever that person is, it is out of his fortune or misfortune. But if you align yourself in any way with him, better think of his virtues, and thereby you will at least not create a mud of your heart. Safety first is the formula. We plant that bad thing in our heart by thinking bad about him. We make a muddle of our own lives. And that we don't deserve to do to ourselves. We always think of good qualities. Life is so precious. Every minute attributes to future progress. And if we get into the habit of imbibing all the wrong that there is in the environment, we are using all those precious moments in muddling our life. We can't see bad in someone because by seeing bad, we incorporate. It's fundamentally be natural, but do what you know to be right. Favor a certain direction. And we know that from listening to Maharishi. And if we forget it, go back and read the Gita, see some tapes. Remind yourself of what he said because it is what you know to be right. Maharishi says, we are born only to bless, not to punish. This you should never forget. We should always see good in others, very important. We're not in a position to criticize anyway. The existence of enemies means for us that our friendliness has not been sufficient enough. God helps those who help themselves. It's a very true saying. We are aware of darkness, but for our own community, we want to have enlightenment. So these little bits of advice that Maharishi's given us are incredibly inspiring. They help us make right choices. This is our education we have here at MIU, is to provide that knowledge. We have that in many ways. And it's just amazing that it's such a resource. It's available to us. Being with Maharishi obviously is the greatest possible thing. It's just an overwhelmingly powerful experience. But if we can't be with him, we can see him. We can see him in tapes that are unbelievable. Tapes that are some of the precious moments I've ever had in my life. I love seeing those tapes again because they recreate an incredible moment where Maharishi, for some reason, he was inspired to go to some incredible depth of what it meant to be a disciple of Gurudev, what it means to something for the world in this direction, something from the world in that direction. These are priceless tapes. They are so inspiring. And they help us to understand and do what we know to be right. We are the luckiest people in the world. We've made a very simple commitment to be in this community, to meditate, to do our group program together. It's changed our lives. It's given us an entirely new paradigm of living. Now we just have to follow the choice that we've made. We just have to be proud of that choice and re-enliven the commitment to the very choice that brought us here. And that choice is just simply to follow the advice of a wise person. Very simple choice. Good choice. Excellent choice. I couldn't tell my children anything more valuable than that. Follow the advice of a wise person. Of course, the next question is, who was a wise person? Maharishi is a wise person. Follow his advice. Best advice I could ever give to my children. And Maharishi's advice back to us is meditate and do what you know to be right. So that is all we have to do, and we just have to be aware that there's one enemy that's always out there that we have to be on guard against, and that's the enemy of fatigue. It's always there. When it attacks us, we make wrong choices. We forget even the simplest. We forget why we came here. We forget why we meditate. We forget everything. It's the most bizarre enemy. It's total illusion. That fatigue arises. We make all kinds of terrible choices. We do things terrible that we regret later on. And they're unbelievably difficult to unravel once we've made the wrong choice. So what we want to do first and foremost is to be committed to protecting our physiology, to protecting our inner physiology, our physiology of consciousness, that which is awake within us, that marvelous feeling of bliss and power that we experience in meditation, that we carry throughout our life, that comes with meditating every day and doing our program. Once we protect that, we've protected the most valuable treasure in the world. We have the key to get out of this prison. But if we allow ourselves to get caught, and Maharishi said it's just the story of the busy businessman. It happens all the time. We get so much creativity that we start doing tons of things and we're having a great time. We travel here and we get fatigued again. It's just the most ridiculous, vicious cycle that's there. By our own flux of creativity, we want to do more. But we have to just remind ourselves that there is a simple choice. Follow Maharishi's advice. Meditate and do what we know to be right. And we know that having a good meditation means being rested. So having a good routine means being rested. So these are marvelous areas of advice. They've been given to us by Maharishi over and over again, 100,000 times, and we just have to remind ourselves. We have everything to get enlightened. We have all the things necessary to make correct choices. We just have to take our own good sense, the advice that we've gotten from Maharishi that brought us to meditation in the first place. Just reminding ourselves of that, and whenever we can, getting exposed to Maharishi's knowledge. In whatever fashion, whatever excuse we can have to be part of Maharishi's knowledge, because being part of that knowledge, every other phrase that Maharishi says reminds us the simple formula. And that's all we need. Let me just end with two quotes here. The first is from Einstein and then from Maharishi. Einstein says, "A human being is part of the whole, called by us universe. A part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separate from the rest. A kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison, restricting us to our personal decisions and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature and its beauty." And Maharishi says, "The whole purpose of life is to gain enlightenment. Nothing else is significant compared to that completely natural, exalted state of consciousness. So always strive for that. Set your life around that goal. Don't get caught up in small things, and then it will be yours." Thank you very much. So, Rick, what time does do we have time for a few questions? Good, okay. So, if anybody has any questions, there's a mic there. What a shy audience. Hi.
Do you have any advice for helping us unravel the dilemmas we make from wrong choices?
I think, you know, that Marcy gives us obviously very good advice there, too, and that is look forward, don't look backwards. You know, it's just like looking at it's like looking at a person who has bad qualities. Because that's another person, that's us back then. So why muddle our heart with that other person's bad qualities? Why not see the good in ourselves? Because, you know, we didn't know before. We really didn't know that was a bad choice. We made it. And, you know, we pay the consequences. But why should we be upset or angry or regret? I mean, some of that's good probably to help us make the right choice the next time. But why should we dwell on it? Because, again, it's like dwelling on another person. We've moved ahead to another stage. And that's kind of like our old self. And that old self was very confused. It just didn't know. Now we know better, so now we should make the correct choice and not dwell on regrets or some kind of negativity there. Just realize what Maharshi says, that we have all of natural law within us. The next minute we can be enlightened, and it's like that whole old self vanishes. So I think, you know, it's just that simple advice.
Thank you.
Yeah. This is really a shy one. Doesn't Dick have something to say up there? Come on, Dick. I've never seen you at a meeting where you didn't have something to say. Come on, you got to say something. Oh, good, okay. Hi. Good, okay.
This is kind of a silly question almost, but I've thought about it for a while. Given the fact that the unified field is omnipresent and natural law is omnipresent, is there really any such thing as a bad choice?
Well, that's a good question, actually. I mean, that from the perspective of unity, you're right. If you were a man in unity consciousness, there would be no bad choice because everything is nature moving within itself. But it's interesting because Maharshi says, you know, you can have knowledge from the perspective of the gold, or knowledge from the perspective of the path. We say there are states of consciousness. Now, actually, from a unity perspective, there's no such thing as a state of consciousness. It's all consciousness. There's no distinction between mind and body. It's all consciousness. So from unity, nature is just operating in its right fashion, and everything is unfolding in a natural way. But from the point of view of the path, we talk about states of consciousness. And we talk about higher states of consciousness. And we talk about, you know, the physiology and consciousness as being separate and one supporting the other, when in fact from unity that's not true. So from the point of view of waking state consciousness, we have free will. And it's kind of important for us to have that concept of free will, because it's from the perspective of the path. And we do feel as if we have free will. Now once we get to cosmic consciousness, our will becomes nature. So suddenly this huge question, philosophical question of free will is transformed. It's not free will, our will is nature's will. And from the perspective of unity, there was never a difference between nature's will and our will. It was always the same will. So knowledge is structured in consciousness, and you can see it from many, many different perspectives. You can say there's free will, you can say there's no free will, you can say it's all determined. Or you can say, gee, you determine everything. You can say, history is done by an individual making choices. Tolstoy at the end of World and Peace has this beautiful thing where he examines the whole history from first the viewpoint of the individual. He says, well, look, at all of history was determined by this individual making that choice, and he took that bridge there, and this happened here, and this battle. Wasn't it great? And then he turns it around and he says, it's too many coincidences. this happened and that happened. I mean, it's absurd. How could that have happened? It's all got to have been fate. So each perspective is correct from its own point of view. But Marshi gives us, from the perspective of gaining enlightenment, that we should make correct choices, that we want to act in such a way that's supportive to others. And it's important, because otherwise a person gets irresponsible. They say, well, it's all predetermined. I can do whatever I want. But clearly, while we're still in waking state consciousness, it's very important to have the perspective of making right choices, because it makes our life easier. We suffer less.
Hi, Keith. Hi. This isn't a question.
Okay.
I really, it's so great to hear you every time you talk. Even just you smiling is great.
She's in unity, though. She sees everything good.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I just thought of two quotes that have always been like a baseline in my life.
Great.
And you said it without knowing it was a quote, or maybe you did know. But it's a quote from Marshi. It says, "The world's greatest enemy is fatigue."
Yes.
And I always remember that. And the other one was, "When we get tired, we invite disaster." And that's like kind of an extreme statement. But every time something happens that is uncomfortable in my life, I just remembered, well, I did stay up late. And then the other thing... I had this thought when this person got up about what do we do if we have made the wrong choices. Something that's always helped me is when something has happened that has been uncomfortable in my own life through making wrong choices, in hindsight, having had that experience then gives me firsthand compassion for others I see in that same situation.
Good. Beautiful.
And so if I had not been in it, then I would not be able to have that compassion for that situation. So just wanted to share that.
Seen something very positive. It's a good perspective. Good. So I think probably we've covered everything on choices. And I hope that... I'm sorry for putting off this course. I wanted to do it, but I got very busy, and I was in Holland for a lot longer than I expected, doing a lot of different things. So I really want to give it everything. I want to hunt for every great quote of Marshi and do it right. So I'd like to, if it's possible, just put it off till spring, and then I think I can do a better job of it. And so those people that are interested in taking that, they could just contact Continue Education, and then we'll try to set it up for a time that's convenient for everybody with a long enough period in advance that you can plan ahead. Thank you very much.